You're listening to episode 3 of season 11 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Plateau. This is the GNU World Order. You are listening to episode 3, season 11. Today I want to talk about Python. Python, the virtual environment, virtual env. It's a confusing topic that I have never really seen explained very well anywhere, but I've used it quite a lot lately, and I figured I'd finally just blow the cover off of it for you. This is the big expose, how to use it, why you should use it, etc., etc. The other thing we want to talk about is some listener feedback. It's always good to discuss. And maybe some other stuff about open source. Let's get started. Let's start with listener feedback. It's always fun. So I got an email from Doru from, I'm gonna say Hungary, if I'm recalling correctly. Could be Romania, but I'm almost sure it's Hungary. I forgot to ask him. But anyway, he emailed me. And he said some nice things. Also said that some of his downloads were failing. So if you're experiencing that, please let me know. It should be working, but he's saying that it was failing frequently for him. But the question, I guess, that he had was that the Pocket Chip. He said, on the topic of the Pocket Chip, how do you think it measures up against the venerable Nokia N900? From the specs that I've seen, the screen is lower resolution, but the hardware is beefier overall. The metal dome keyboard looks to me like something that only masochists or guitar players would use for longer than a couple of minutes. I'm hoping that the chip systems will get enough traction to keep the software ecosystem from getting stale too quickly, but in the meantime, sticking with my trusty N900. That's a great question. Great comment. Frankly, yeah, you're right. I feel like, I almost feel like if I had an N900, I'd stick with it as well. I never got an N900. I got a N800. No, I got a N770. And then, what was it? The 800 was the one with the touchpad, I think. And then one with, or maybe it was the 810 came out with the keyboard, the slide out keyboard. And then the 900, of course, was the phone / Nokia internet device, and I never got one, so I can't really comment on how it compares to the 900 because I don't have one. I would love to have one, although at this point I'm not sure that I really need one, so I'm not really sure that I'll ever really pursue that. I wouldn't say that the Pocket Chip, I would frankly, is what I'm trying to get, what I want to say is that I feel like I would stick with the Nokias, to be honest, and I can't be 100% sure. Now, on all of these small devices, like the low-powered small devices, so far my experience has been the thing that kills them in the end, well, the two things that kills them in the end are the internet and, as Doru said in his email, the software ecosystem going stale. Those are the two things. Like my 770 or whatever it is, I keep saying it's not a 770, it's an 800. N800. Sorry, I don't know why suddenly I thought I had a 770. Anyway, N800, it's still a great little device. I have actually two of them, because Ken Fallon sent me his old one as a backup. So, it's still a great system. I love this thing. I really do. And a friend of mine, Vulcan Rider, told me to put a really cool, I think it was Vulcan Rider, put a really cool skin on it, so the interface is really nice. Really great device. I love it. Absolutely love it. But finding updated software for it is not easy. And anytime you want to go out onto the internet for anything, I'm talking anything, it is painful. It's absolutely painful. And I mean, yeah, you can use, like, lightweight browsers and go to lightweight sites. That's fine. But I mean, I'm talking about the evil internet, the dark side of the internet, where all you want to do is look up one stupid recipe. And in order to do that, you have to go through 20 different pop-up screens, 3 different front site page, web pages with full screen video. You know, it absolutely kills it. And the device just doesn't know how to get around that. So, in a sense, I kind of feel like none of these things are really internet devices. They're just networkable devices. And that the Pocket Chip does okay. You're absolutely correct about the keyboard. It's a horrible keyboard. I can't believe they committed that thing to the board. It's terrible. There's no way that anyone would use that keyboard for anything realistic. You are going to be using a plug-in keyboard or a Bluetooth keyboard. The weird thing about the Pocket Chip is that the Bluetooth interface doesn't really exist, because for some stupid reason on the Pocket Chip, they don't give you a desktop. They, you know, they give you that front end sort of touch screen, which at the time when I saw it, I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool way of doing things. But I did notice that their configuration was a little bit incomplete, their config screen. And then I looked up on their site how to marry a Bluetooth device to it, and it turns out that Pocket Chip, you don't really have a way to do that easily. I mean, you can do it, but if you don't use the Pocket Chip, if you take your chip out of the case and just plug it into a normal monitor, you'll get a desktop, and you could just do it with a desktop. So it's kind of weird that they like chose some of the choices that they chose. But yeah, the keyboard, you're not going to use it. You're just not going to use it. It's a horrible keyboard. It really is. It doesn't take the key presses that you want it to take. The keys are all in the wrong places, which, yes, I mean, some of them are handy, like the up arrow, the arrow keys being in where they are kind of helps sometimes, but the fact that there's not a control key on both sides and little things. Keyboard's not realistic. Just forget it. So yeah, would I suggest a Pocket Chip over a Nokia? Nah, not really. It's a Raspberry Pi, and you can get it and treat it like a Pi, or you can get it and treat it like a handheld computer, but ultimately it's still just a Raspberry Pi, except it just happens to have a screen. It's very low powered, it's clunky, but it's charming. But yeah, if you've got a Nokia, you practically have the same thing. I started hearing about this thing called Virtual Env a lot back when I was investigating Python. I'll say that I'm paid at this point to work a lot in Python, so I'd go so far as to say I'm no longer investigating Python. I'm using it and getting paid for it, so whatever that makes me, I don't believe that makes me a developer or anything, but it does make me someone who's sort of entrenched in this world. Even then, I didn't really have necessarily an excuse to use Virtual Env, because the environment at my work is pretty heavily structured. It's not something where you have to develop within a certain environment, or it is a place that you have to develop in a certain environment, so there's never a question of, is my development environment different than my user's environment? Because it's always the same. Now, at home, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, it's almost certainly not the case. If you're developing Python at home, or in the cafe, you know, on your laptop, for instance, you may have, let's just say, libfoo installed, or pyfoo, as it might be called, pyfoo, and you're developing, and you're ready, and you've used pyfoo a lot, and you're really happy with it, and so now you're going to push your software out, so there's this dependency on pyfoo, and you push your software to the internet, you give it the label open source, people are happy, people go download it, they try to run it, and it fails. Why did it fail? Oh, because you're using pyfoo. Fair enough. You tell everyone, hey, make sure that you have pyfoo installed, and then you can use my software. And that typically works, except you also used PyBar, and you didn't really think about using PyBar. It wasn't something that you were even sort of aware of it. You just did, because you always use PyBar. It's like it's in your toolkit. Problem is, it's not in everybody else's toolkit. So there, now you have to tell everyone, hey, you have to also install PyBar, so pyfoo and PyBar, and then you can use my software. So that can get really complex pretty quickly if you don't track it. And it's, like I say, it's the times where your environment just is so naturally integrated with, you know, these extra libraries or vice versa. And you just don't think about it, you know? Like, those aren't extra packages to you. Those are your normal, everyday Python packages. I mean, that's just the the Klaatu base. Like, obviously everyone else should have this installed, and that's not necessarily the case. So that's the point of virtualenv. Virtualenv is kind of this layer that you can use in Python to separate what everyone's going to get when they install Python, no matter what, versus what, like everyone actually installs anyway in your mind, or probably more realistic, what you always install anyway. So it separates like the official Python distribution from your personal interpretation of what the Python distribution really is. So you'll hear a lot about virtualenv. Python people tend to talk about it a lot. The problem with that is that in a lot of places where people are talking about that, they don't really think to explain it because they're assuming everyone in the room sort of knows about it already. So they're sort of referring to it like, presumably you're developing with virtualenv, and then they keep going, and you're like, well, I'm not, but I guess that's okay. Let's just skim by that. And they do. So it's really kind of tricky sometimes to kind of get a sort of a nailed down definition of like, well, what exactly is virtualenv and how do I use it? It's actually really cool and it's not that hard. Let's talk about it and get you started with it. First things first, and that is to get start to start using pip, PIP. I may have mentioned this before. The pip system is kind of like the yum or the ports system of Python. Now, Python, obviously on Linux, almost always is pre-installed, so it can be and is typically managed by the OS, by the OS itself, by your package manager. But pip, and you could probably install pip from your package manager if it's not already installed, but pip will enable you to manage Python packages really straight from sort of Python's repository, as it were. The repository itself, I think, or the, I shouldn't call it a repository, but place for all these Python packages is if you go to py, oh geez, what is it? PyPy.org, I think. No, sorry. Well, I mean it is, but the place that I usually go is PyPy, that's PyPy, dot python.org, and that's the Python package index. So pip can sort of tap into this and pull packages and updates and things like that from there for you. So generally speaking, it's a good idea to have pip installed, and certainly at work, for me, it's essential because it's I don't have permission to install Python packages to the root level of my work environment, and pip makes that really easy to manage because you can just pass the dash dash user flag to pip and have it just install everything within your home directory, which is quite nice. So if you have pip, you should update it. If you don't have it, you should install it. And you can do that from the pypy.python.org should tell you how to do that. There's like a script that they have from, I think it's bootstrap.py, PYPA, .io/git-pip.py. You can wget that and then you can install it and then pip is installed. So once you have pip installed, you can install this other package called virtualenv. Now, if you don't want to use pip, you don't necessarily have to. You could just go to your repository and install virtualenv. I'm just saying that a lot of the Python developers tend, from what in my experience, tend to use pip. If you've got different thoughts on that, let me know. So system-wide, that would just be a sudo or su-c whatever pip install virtualenv. And if you're just doing it to your local user environment, as I do, it's pip install dash dash user virtualenv. And that installs virtualenv. So you're one step away from actually using virtualenv. And virtualenv will seem a little bit magical, so I'm going to break it down for you so that it doesn't seem magical at all. You can really think of virtualenv as a kind of a superficial cheroot. If you're not familiar with cheroot, I should probably mention that that's basically you lying to your computer. When you launch Python, normally your computer asks silently, but it does ask where it should look to find Python modules, and you, not directly, but you, your computer tells it that the modules are located in a certain number of directories, and you can verify this. You can see this in action if you just open up a terminal and type in Python, and then you get those three chevrons and the prompt, the Python prompt, and then import sys, import space sys, and then just do the command or the Python command sys.path, or Python function sys.path, and that returns a series of directories in a list, and it's something like, you know, user lib python 3.4 and user lib python 3.4/platform-x86_64-linux-gnu and user lib python 3.4/lib-dinload and lots of other things. So all kinds of folders pop up, and that's the system path for Python. That's how it knows where to look for modules, so that when you say import foo from bar or whatever, then it knows where to go to look to see where foo is, or bar and foo is, are. If you use virtualenv to cheroot, as it were, or to lie to your computer, then you can create kind of a layer outside of that. So let's just do that, and then you'll see the difference. So virtualenv, you can get out of Python, so exit parentheses parentheses, and then type in into your just normal bash prompt, virtualenv my_fake_env. So you have just, if when you do that, if virtualenv can't be found, then you have either not installed it, which you should look into, or you've installed it locally, and you have not added that local installation path to your, or that local installation location to your path. So you may have to look for it in your home, /.local/bin/virtualenv. I mention that because that's exactly what happened to me the first time I was trying to use it. I couldn't find it, couldn't understand why. And that was because it was located in some place that I'd never added to my system, to my path, my user path. And you should probably add that to your path in the future. So, you know, $home/.local/bin to path in your bash RC, or CSHRC, whatever you use. Pip, I think, will take over from there and install a reasonable base environment for you. And then once you get that prompt back, take a look at your little environment and see what's going on. So you can do an ls, and you can do a pipe grep env, and you'll find that a folder is now located in the current directory called myfake_env. And then if you list that directory, lsmyfakeenv, you'll see that it contains a bin folder, a lib folder, a pip-selfcheck.json. Interesting. I wonder what this is all about. Well, we can activate the environment. There's a couple of different ways to do that, depending on what shell you're working in. But if you're using bash, then you can use just the standard activate command. If you're using something else, look in the directory myfakeenv/bin and see what options you have. And there's usually, like, there's certainly an activate.csh. I know because I use tcsh at work, and that's the one I have to use. But at home I use bash, so there's the activate one, and there's activate.fish and activate.whatever. So lots to choose from. So use the one that makes sense for you. And since I am at home right now as I record this, I will use the bash one. So we could do, and if you're not sure what shell you're using, just do an echo $shell, all capitals with the shell, and it'll tell you, oh, bin bash, or oh, bin tsh, whatever. So then you can source /myfakeenv/bin/activate. Or again, if you're on a different shell, it would be whatever shell. Source myfakeenv/bin/activate.csh. Whatever. It's not rocket science. Pretty simple. Figure it out. Okay, so once your environment has been activated, then your shell prompt will change. Whatever your shell prompt used to be, it will now be prepended by myfakeenv in brackets. And that's how you know you are now in a fake environment. You're in a virtual environment. What does that mean to you? Well, let's have a look. So type in Python within your virtualenv, import sys again, import space sys, and then do a sys path, sys.path. And then you'll see a completely different list of folders, and they will all be prepended, or they'll all be based from slash home slash your username, cloud2, whatever, slash myfake on slash lib slash python 3.4, home cloud2 myfake on slash lib slash python 3.4 slash plat dash dash, dash x64 underscore 64 x86 64 linux dash gnu, and so on and so on. In other words, the virtual environment has pulled the rug out from under your computer, and it's basically pretending that the rest of the computer doesn't exist. You are back to a basically a stock install of Python, because it's all within this one folder, this one fake environment that you created called myfake.env. Now, to get out of your environment, you can use deactivate. That's just the word deactivate. You can't just say it. You have to type it, but yeah, deactivate, and then your prompt returns to normal. So, obviously, you wouldn't just create it, activate it, and then deactivate it. That's not the usual workflow. The more common workflow would be activating it, and then working, doing your work, doing your development. You would then develop Python. And when you run into something that you realize you don't have in this virtual environment, that's the thing that you need to make sure that people get included. That's it. That's the point of virtual env. So you're developing and you're like import foo, and you get an error and it says I don't know what foo is, and then you realize, oh, I need to pip install foo. And so now I have it, but at the end of the day, you'll look at everything that you've imported, you know, you'll look at your virtual environment, you'll see exactly what you have installed, and that's your list of dependencies, right there, that's it. Or if you're packaging it up into something, into a self-contained executable or something, then you know, if I take my lib folder from my virtual environment and put that into my package, then when someone tries to run this application, it will have everything that it needs, because I know that as long as they're running the right version of Python, they've got a stock install with it in addition with my libs from my virtual env added to their environment. No matter what's in their environment, everything will work. It works really well. It's really, really nice. Is it absolutely necessary? No, not really. I've developed Python stuff without it, and you can do it. It works fine. I've developed Python stuff with an ad hoc version of this, where I have a command where I tell Python, you know, where I prepend Python with Python path equals, and I point it to the place where these certain things exist. And then I know that that's, you know, in that path, all the libraries there are now being pulled in. So yeah, I mean, there are ways around this, in other words, but virtual env does kind of keep you honest. It highlights when you're deviating from stock Python, and it makes sure that you know exactly what people are going to need to run the thing and get the exact same response. And that's important, because you don't really want to deal with stupid problems. When you're debugging, you want to debug the actual errors and not the stupid things where you just forgot to tell people to install libfoo, libbar, and libbaz. That's not what you want to spend your time on. So virtual env is a great little system. Pip makes it quite fluid, quite easy. Use those two things as I have described, and your Python experience will be much, much better. Maybe not right now, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday when you have other users using your software, that's when you'll really find that it paid off. Enjoy. It's a modern world. We have modern conveniences. We have more or less been conditioned that everything out there is available for a price. Like, anything you want, as long as you can afford it, you can pretty much make it happen. And that's one of those sort of facts of life that we kind of grow up with, and we learn to both love and hate, because after all, it's socially unjust, it's horrible, that anything is possible just for the wealthy people, but withheld from normal folk, And yet there's some comfort there, right? I mean, anything's possible. If we can just save up enough money, which, depending on what you're after, you may never be able to do. But if we do, or else we wait until someone else, who is rich, happens to want the same thing as we do, maybe we can ride on their coattails. But something could, anything can be purchased into reality. I mean, at this point, a mission to Mars, essentially is being purchased into reality, if we are to believe the things that we see on the internet. Money brings hope and comfort. Money can make everything possible, every dream come true. And maybe that's why it's so scary to us when we come across someone or something for whom money holds no appeal. Like, seriously, go hunt down someone who doesn't want your money. It's like staring into the cold black eyes of someone who has no soul. It's amazing. It's a beautiful thing to witness. They're impossible to reach. It's unsettling to most people. Like if you can turn down some lump sum of money, you will freak that person out. They won't know what to do about you. Like, how can you refuse money? How can you not do what I'm telling you to do when I offer you money to go do it? My money is supposed to force anything I want to go my way. Like, maybe not this much money, but if I add more money, then that surely that'll do it. So it's funny. It's really a funny thing to witness. If you can witness it, or if you could be on either end of it, it's really, really fantastic. And of course, this is a big topic and one that I don't really want to get into from the social angle. It's not what this podcast is about. It's kind of, I mean, it is certainly socially why governments, for instance, are less concerned about money, which is an imaginary construct, and a lot more interested in, for instance, land ownership, which everyone needs because everyone has to exist somewhere, right? You've got to stand on something. So if you take land away, people, the cold black eyes of someone with no soul, as they're refusing your money, if you start taking their land away, that becomes a lot more persuasive. That's when things start to really happen. But as I say, that's socially, I don't really care about that in this podcast. So what we should talk about is how all of this applies to software and open source, certainly. So in software, I can observe sometimes people using non-open source software, and it's kind of interesting to see how they deal with problems. So first there are the workarounds, and we've all been here, but you've certainly, if you haven't been here in a while, it'll sound familiar, but you'll see it in other people. They do the workaround, right? It's the thing that takes effort, but it's still somehow more convenient. You know the kind. I mean, we even do them in the open source world for fear of having to learn something new sometimes. You can't seem to get the printer to cooperate, so we'll export it to a PDF, put the file on a thumb drive and walk it over to the printer, plug the thumb drive in and print it up directly off the office printer. Problem solved. It's like it's a small, mysterious, weird problem. We don't really know why the printer's not working from our computer. It should. Everyone else is working right now, but mine doesn't, so I'm going to do this. It's a little bit stupid, but it works. It kind of fits into my rhythm. It gets me out of my chair. It keeps me out of having to figure out what's wrong. Yeah, I'll just do it. Usually, that happens, and then you're sitting around one afternoon and you're bored, so you're like, well, you know what? My printer hasn't been working in a while, so I'm getting tired of this one workaround that I've been doing, so I'll do an internet search and try to figure out, see if there's some, it could be, maybe it's something simple. So you do the investigation. The workaround has become problematic or annoying enough, or you're bored enough that you do want to get it fixed. So you look into it and you see what other people are doing, what you might be able to do. And finally, then there's the payment stage. You get to that problem where you can't, or you get to the stage where you can't fix the problem yourself. So you make the call and you offer to pay someone else to make the problem go away. Or maybe you don't make a call. You just go to a store and buy a new printer, whatever. Point being, the ultimate solution can be achieved through the exchange of money. And I think the impression most of us have deep down is in the modern world, nothing is impossible. Like the word impossible, we're really taught, and I think it's a good thing ultimately, but we're taught, that the word impossible and can't, those are essentially bad words in our society. And like I say, I mean, I really do think that that's actually a good thing. I don't like talking in terms of why something can't be done, you know? That doesn't seem constructive to me. And certainly in the modern world, since we're so often talking about technology in terms of, you know, productivity, like what can we do? It's we're usually doing it through technology. So we keep thinking that technology, especially, everything's possible in technology. I mean, we've seen such incredible things within our lifetime. There's just, it's like, why wouldn't things be possible with technology? Like, obviously it's possible. It's just some features happen to be locked behind a paywall, and we're okay with that. We want to send emails in bulk without getting throttled by the ISP. Well, we can pay a little extra, and we'll get the business email account service, and suddenly we can do that. We want to get a faster internet? Not a problem. Upgrade our internet plan, and we suddenly get more bits. We even see diseases sometimes as a pay-to-play scheme. Do you have an incurable disease? Hey, if you've got enough money, there's suddenly a bunch of things that they can do to keep you alive. It's brilliant. Again, sorry, bringing it back to software. The result of this kind of nothing is impossible mindset is that we have a serious problem that we can't solve. We pay for it to have it solved for us, but obviously the, you know, if you follow that through, somebody is still coming up with a solution. It's not the money that's making the thing possible. Somebody somewhere is figuring something out. And we're an advanced civilization, so surely we don't really think that the buy now button in our web browser is the thing that's auto-generating from the depths of the abyss, an answer from nothing, I hope. So why am I talking about this in terms of open source? Well, since so many computer users are trained to believe that everything is available just around the corner of the next paywall, I do notice that open source can sometimes be unsettling to people. With open source, a lot of the problems, past like the basic configuration and troubleshooting stuff, are problems that can't be ushered away with a payment plan. We've tried it, it doesn't work, it's open source. There isn't one definitive set of problems that everyone in the world working on open source can sit down to solve. We each have our own list of things we need done, and it's not money that's the problem. The problem is that a solution hasn't been invented yet. But that's what we're working on just as quickly as we find them. And by we, of course, I don't mean we, I mean you, each individual, like every person has a life and they're making it work, or they're making open source work within their life. A lot of people seem to have an illusion that open source is the name of a company, a place where we all go each day and we sit down at our desks, or we remote in because that's what high-tech people do, right? And we have meetings and things are mapped out and we all sort of make decisions about what our next goal is going to be. And that does happen in some places, but if we see open source like that, we're looking at it backwards. Open source isn't something that you go into in order to join. Open source is a label that gets stuck onto you post facto. If I make some software for myself or for someone I'm helping and I post its source code online, then when the internet gnomes come around at night and put labels on things declaring it open source or not, that's what my software gets. It gets the open source label. If I add a license explicitly stating that you can use it and change it and share it, then it gets an upgraded label that says it's liberated, it's free software. Software that I gift to you with the promise that I can never take it back away from you. You can use it and keep it forever. But to do that, I didn't have to go and sign up with anyone. You know, I didn't have to register anywhere. I didn't have to log my time or submit my code for approval. I just wrote some stuff and said, hey, anybody wants to use it, go for it. Now, if you come around and offer to pay me to make my code better, I may or may not agree. First of all, I might not agree that what you want is quote-unquote better. That's a big one. Like, people don't seem to understand that. It's like, how can I not give you money to make this the way that I want it to be? I mean, that would be so much better for me. Yeah, but maybe that just goes against everything I believe in. Maybe I just totally don't think that that's the better option. I think it's better the way I did it. Okay, so secondly, I might not agree that the pay that you're offering me is worth the effort. I mean, there's that problem. And then finally, I might not want to get involved in something that brings along that new dimension of expectation. So if you pay me for something, then surely that thing is now subject to your approval. And that is very upsetting to people. That those three things, that's really, that's the classic kind of like, What do you mean my money's no good here? Don't you know who I am? You know, that's what that is. It's, no, I don't, your money is no good to me. I don't want it. You can't make me do anything, even though you are waving the money in front of my face. Now, the obvious sympathetic question here is, why would anyone ever want to use a product in which there's no recourse that you can take when something goes wrong? In fact, how can open source even be taken seriously at all if there's no way for a customer base to call up someone and say, hey, this needs to be fixed, this problem exists, I want it repaired? And that's the thing about open source, though. With open source, just as anybody can choose to not be swayed by money, anybody else in the world can choose that can decide that your money is completely, perfectly fine. They can work on it for nothing but the money if they choose to. Open source is truly liberated. If you want to pay someone to hack on it and add features for you, you can. If you want to rally up a group of people who want the same features and kind of pitch in money for it together, then you can do that. The difference is that the driving force comes from the need for something. While in the closed and the corporate models of software, this stuff is just churned out and customers build their workflows based around it. It's a little like the paywall itself. Demand-driven development requires effort from users who must figure out what they want, and that's a tall order, especially since we're all being trained on a daily basis that adapting is the way that we're supposed to work. It's like we're trained to create things responsively, as a response to something that's handed to us. You give me something, and I'll work around it, or I'll work with it, but really we're working around it. That's how the non-open software development model works. Now, when I want something better in that model, what do? Well, I pay extra, because then they unlock the extra features for me. We can work with that. It's predictable. It's secure. There's a clear definition on what our rights are. You know, there's not really any... We know exactly where we stand. We know that as long as we pay, then we get supplied with the infrastructure that it might not be exactly what we wanted or even what we need, but it's in the same ballpark, and we can adapt to it. If we need something different, we'll pay extra. If we need something that simply does... that doesn't even exist yet, then we'll get up and go figure something else out. That's open source. That's the part where open source comes in, right there. It's when you're sick and tired of working around someone else's quote-unquote solution, and you get up from behind your desk, or you get up from behind your computer, get off the couch, wherever you are. It's not as comfortable as all the stuff that you didn't have to think about. It takes thought, and it takes effort, and it takes time, and it's something that you'd probably... You know, you'd rather be doing something else than solving this problem. But when the money runs out, or when your money simply can't buy what you need from the corporate model, it's the principles of open source that's going to come to your rescue. Because open source is production for use, not for profit. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
swirling, churning waves of destruction from ultimate space.